Good afternoon. Great to be in Dallas, of course, as always. As Mr. Hooser mentioned, I know that perhaps some might already be on the road for their travels, to their winter break activities. We have Winter Family Weekend in Cincinnati, and then there's Winter Camp in Wisconsin this year. My son Matthew will be flying out on Monday to attend Winter Camp, so he's excited about that. And we're excited for him. That's the first time that he'll be able to go up there and do that. You know, Matthew might have a snippet of what real winter is like. We lived in Iowa when Matthew was between the ages of about 2.5 to about 5 years old. So I remember one particular experience. We were getting out of the van at Sabbath services, and I was holding Matthew's hand, and we were facing about a 40-mile-an-hour wind, and the wind chill factor was about minus 20. So the wind was strong enough that I knew that if I would have let go of Matthew's hand, he would have just blown away. I mean, it's almost like his legs were out here like this, you know. So minus 20 is brutal indeed. And perhaps Matthew will get a taste of that when he goes up to Wisconsin at the end of December. Whose idea was that anyway, to go to Wisconsin in the end of December, right off the Great Lakes, too? So, well, you can ask him about that when he returns, how that was. Greetings to all of you on the cybercast, as Mr. Hooser mentioned. Hello, Mrs. Hooser. Good to see you. Or good for you to see me, I hope. Well, what I'd like to talk about today is a dirty word. It's that dirty word called works. Now, you might recall a while back, it's actually been several years ago, I gave a message titled Works of the Law. So actually, you probably don't recall that because it's been quite a long time ago. But in that sermon, I talked about the works of the law as Paul used that phrase in places like Galatians and in Romans. You know, we saw how words like law can be very generic in their usage. You know, just like in the English language, words in the Greek language can by themselves have such a generic meaning. And it's always the context in which words are used that we can understand their meaning. So when Paul used the word law in context with the ritual works that are associated with Judaism, well, we were able to see exactly what he meant by law because of that phrase, works of law. You know, it's all those works that were involved in worshiping God through the Levitical administration. You know, it's clear and it's unmistakable when you consider that context. You know, when Paul used the word law in other contexts, well, it was clear by that context what he meant as well. You know, for by the law comes the knowledge of sin. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law said, thou shalt not covet. And so what's the context of that generic word, law, there, you know, being used in that sense? Well, it's obvious, right? You know, that's a clear and unmistakable reference to the Ten Commandments as the law that tells us what sin is. Well, just like we saw that the word law is generic, and it's only understood by its context, well, in this sermon, I'd like to look at that word works. It follows the same general rule. You know, it's a generic word, and it's only properly understood when placed in its context. The Greek word is ergon, and ergon means work. That's what the word means. To do labor, an occupation, you know, the effort that you put into something. The ritual surrounding the Levitical priesthood was their work. It was their occupation. You know, it's what they did that required physical effort. But really, when you use the word ergon in other contexts, well, it becomes clear that the word itself is not a negative thing. You know, it's not a dirty word. And we can even use it in a Christian context and it still not be a dirty word, as we're going to see in the sermon. You know, we're all expected to work throughout our lives, aren't we? Paul tells the members in Thessalonica that he who does not work should not eat. So even in a non-religious sense, we can see that we can examine the context where the word is placed, and we can know what Paul's talking about when he tells us that work is a good thing. And what is the context there in 2 Thessalonians? Well, he's referring to the type of work that allows us to eat. Works are a good thing when those works are productive works that puts food on our table. Let's notice a passage in James chapter 2, if you'll turn over there, please. James, the second chapter. Now, here's the famous passage that caused Martin Luther so many sleepless nights. You know, we're going to see that the word works can be used in a religious context, in a worshipful context, and it still not be a dirty word. Let's notice James chapter 2 and verse 14. Verse 14, "What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, 'Depart in peace, be warmed and filled,' but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also, by itself, if it does not have work, if it does not have works, is dead. Faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead." So we learn here that our faith has to be combined with action, or it is no faith at all. You know, Dr. Ward used to have certain simple phrases that he repeated over and over again to us college students. And you know, as the years and the decades have passed, I'm beginning to see the wisdom in that method of teaching, imprinting young minds with simple phrases over and over again until we never forget them. And his simple phrase on faith was this: faith is believing God and doing what he says. Yeah, it's real simple and to the point, isn't it? And yet it covers so much. Faith is believing God and doing what he says. Now, what's particularly amusing about this Dr. Wardism, if I can call it that, is that I already had this reference embedded in my notes for this sermon. And then last week I attended Sabbath services over in East Texas where Dr. Ward gave the sermon. And guess what he said during that sermon? Faith is believing God and doing what he says. You know, all I could do was chuckle to myself because after nearly 30 years, I'm still being reinforced with these gems of truth from the instructor. Well, we can see how this principle is reinforced here in James' second chapter. You know, James points to Abraham's experience with offering his son Isaac. Abraham believed God. He believed that God was going to keep his promise to have the blessing be passed down through Isaac. He believed that. And then he went on to do what God told him to do. That is to take his son, his only son, bind him upon the altar, and give him as a sacrifice. Now, how was he able to do that? Well, because he believed God. That's a bit of a logical quandary here, isn't it? You know, God promised Abraham that in Isaac your seed shall be blessed. Abraham believed that. And God promised Abraham that this would be so. God told Abraham then to take his son and put him on the altar and sacrifice him. Abraham set out to do that. Now, how did he reason his way through that? Well, let's notice that in Hebrews chapter 11, if we could turn over there. Hebrews, the 11th chapter. Here in Hebrews 11, we'll see how Abraham used what I would call some inspired human reasoning. You know, he reasoned that God would just bring Isaac back to life. That could be the only conclusion that he could come to. You know, human reasoning sometimes gets a bad rap when you use that phrase, human reasoning. It just sounds kind of bad, but we can have good human reasoning, inspired human reasoning, even though it might not necessarily be correct. Abraham's human reasoning here wasn't correct, but I would still call it inspired because he believed God, and he believed in God's absolute power to accomplish what he said. And in this case, he's like, well, I'm going to have to kill my son Isaac, but God will just bring him back to life. Well, let's just notice that in verse 17, Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called, concluding that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. So I'd call that a brilliant piece of human reasoning here. You know, God never said that that was how it was going to work out. You know, he never said he was going to allow Abraham to go all the way in killing Isaac and then raising him back from the dead. Of course, he had to make sure Abraham believed that he had to go all the way. Otherwise, the sacrifice wasn't, in his mind, was not complete. Abraham had to believe that he had to go all the way. But Abraham allowed his human reasoning to be guided by his unwavering faith in God's promises. And then he proceeded from there. And that's what I would call pretty good human reasoning. Now, so many folks who are perhaps new to the faith or maybe they have a somewhat flawed or immature view of faith, would conclude that faith is simply believing in God. That is, believing that God exists, period. You know, end of story. That's all you need, because believe that God exists and you're done. And that is faith. But as we all know, that's a beginning faith. It is faith. Believing that the Creator God exists in our secular age is a measure of faith. But if it doesn't grow into something else, it becomes a dead faith. You know, a useless faith. As James goes on to say here in the second chapter, even the demons believe that God exists. You know, they believe that. So yes, we all start out there. We believe in God. We can even take that belief in God one step further. And we can believe that God is a God of absolute power. You know, Abraham had that. He believed God had the power to resurrect Isaac from the dead and to fulfill the promise. And then that takes us to the third level of faith. You know, we actually believe God. That is, we believe what he says. We believe his promises. You know, we don't just believe in God. We believe God. God promised Abraham that in Isaac, your seed would be blessed. And Abraham believed that. And once we actually believe God, that is, we believe what he says is true and absolute, well, then we can believe that when he tells us to do something, we ought to do it. So the fourth level of faith there is when our belief allows us to do what he says. Why? Because we believe God. So it wasn't that Abraham's works made him righteous. He wasn't justified by works, as James goes on to say there in the second chapter. He says there in the second chapter there that it was Abraham's belief in God that made him righteous. But that his belief is what motivated him to do what God told him to do. So James will conclude then that faith and works go together. They go hand in hand. But clearly we are justified by faith and not by works. It's just that faith without works is dead. Doesn't that make your head spin a little bit? You know, this is the conflict that Martin Luther faced. You know, this is what drove him crazy. He couldn't get past that. And that's probably a sermon all by itself, you know, just to examine justification and how it works. But I'm not going to do that today. Suffice to say that I look at it like this. You know, you can have faith without works. The Pharisees in Judaism had that. And you can have, you can have works without faith. That's what the Pharisees had. They had works without faith. You can have faith without works, but it becomes a dead faith. So one without the other, it just doesn't work. And this doesn't have to be a brain teaser. You know, Abraham was able to wrap his mind around this. It was easy for Abraham to wrap his mind around this. Well, maybe it wasn't easy, but he did wrap his mind around it. Abraham believed God, faith, and then Abraham obeyed God, works. It's a simple formula, and I think we can leave it at that for now. So how then do you and I believe God and do what he says? Well, we read from the law and the testimony. And then we become doers of the law and the testimony. That's what James tells us earlier there in the epistle. You know, if we can look back and into the first chapter here, are we still in James? I think maybe we went over to Hebrews chapter 11. So let's go back to James, and let's look in James the first chapter, and we'll read in verse 21, James 1, verse 21. Therefore, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word, which is able to save your souls. But be doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, well, he's like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself, he goes away, and he immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. So what is the value of being able to look into God's law and then follow it and do what the law says? Well, James calls this liberty. It's liberty to live by God's laws. You know, the carnal mind says the law of God is bondage. But here we see it's called a law of liberty. And the doer of the law is blessed in what he does. So how do we become doers of God's laws? You know, that right there is a bit of a vague statement, isn't it? You know, be doers of God's law. That's the end of my sermon. You know, I'll just go sit down now. Now, what we need to do is expound on this a little bit. What does it mean to be doers of God's law, and how does one go about it? let's look at a few examples of how others have looked into that perfect law of liberty and then went on to live by the principles that were outlined in that law. Now, the most practical and clear example of looking into the law and then applying it to our lives is given by Jesus Christ. You might recall a more recent message that I gave just a few months ago. It was a sermonette titled, "He Will Magnify the Law." He will magnify the law. And if you missed that, it is available for download on UCG's main sermon archive. I checked that just to be sure, and it is there. Again, the title is, "He Will Magnify the Law." And I gave that message about 6 months ago. And that phrase is given to us by Isaiah in the 42nd chapter, where he prophesied that when the Messiah comes, he would not abolish the law or do away with God's law, but rather he would magnify the law. That is, he would bring clarity and better understanding to God's laws. And we saw in that sermonette how in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus Christ did just that. He began by reassuring us that he did not come to do away with God's law. No, not even one stroke of the pen would pass from the law. He didn't come to abolish the law, but rather to fulfill the law. And we spent some time in that sermonette talking about what it means to fulfill. Fulfill does not mean abolish or terminate, as so many people seem to think. Otherwise, the statement is kind of absurd when you think about it, right? I mean, if fulfill means abolish, then when he said, "I didn't come to abolish the law, but to fulfill," well, that's like saying, "I didn't come to abolish the law, but rather I came to abolish the law." You know, that's ridiculous, right? Fulfill means to fill up. It means to bring our understanding to full measure. That is, to magnify. Just like Isaiah told us that he predicted that the Messiah would do that. And if there continues to be any confusion as to what fulfill means, well, then Jesus Christ lays it all to rest when, with the practical examples that follow. There in Matthew chapter 5. There in Matthew 5, we saw that adultery begins in the eyes, the lust of the eyes. You know, Mr. Hines mentioned Job earlier, where he said, "I did not give over to, I made a covenant with my eyes so that I would not look upon, you know, young women with that kind of lust." It doesn't actually begin with the physical act. You know, that's the end result. The beginning takes place in the mind with our desires. And we saw that murder begins with when we harbor hatred in our hearts towards our brother. The physical act, again, is the end result, not the beginning. And that was the law, magnified. And we're not going to turn there to Matthew chapter 5, since I did cover that in detail in the previous sermonette. And if you didn't get to hear that sermonette, I know most of you know the passage there very well. Matthew chapter 5 is a very well-known passage that I'm sure you're all familiar with. But it's worth mentioning just to get the pattern down. You know, Jesus Christ teaches us that we can look into the law of God and we can meditate on it. We can think about it and see how it applies to our lives. You know, we look for the spiritual intent. Let's notice how the psalmist described it in Psalm chapter 119, if you'll turn over there. Psalm chapter 119. You know, there's so many nuggets of treasure that I could read here in the longest of psalms. But I chose a passage that I think is going to jump out at you right away in Psalm 119. I know we've sung these words so many times over the years. You know, hopefully these words are imprinted into your hearts and into your minds as a result of singing them over and over again. Let's notice how David uses God's law in his life. Psalm 119, we're going to read verses 97 through 103. Verse 97, "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day." It's my meditation all the day. You know, what's he saying here? That he actually thinks about and he ponders God's laws throughout the day. How to apply this law? You know, what does that law mean? What is God trying to teach me here through this law? That's the title of my sermon today, Meditations on God's Law. "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. You, through your commandments, make me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever with me. I have more understanding than all my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the ancients, because I keep your precepts. I have restrained my feet from every evil way that I may keep your word. I have not departed from your judgments, for you yourself have taught me. How sweet are your words to my taste, sweeter than honey to my mouth. Again, that's a very familiar passage, and I'm sure you can hear the song in your mind after reading that. So now let's look at this a little deeper as we examine some more examples from the New Testament. And we'll see a few examples of how the Apostle Paul meditated on God's law. We'll see how he pondered it, how he thought it over carefully, and how he applied the law to practical, real-world situations. We'll see how he helped his readers to see the intent and the meaning behind the law. So let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. You know, since it is the Apostle Paul, and basically only the Apostle Paul, that many point to when they want to uphold this idea that the law is abolished, well, perhaps it might be helpful to look directly at an incident where Paul is discussing the law and its application. So we'll notice 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Let's just start reading right in verse 1. Verse 1, am I not an apostle? Am I not free? Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If I am not an apostle to others, yet doubtless I am to you. For you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. My defense to those who examine me is this. Do we have no right to eat or drink? Do we have no right to take on a believing wife, as do also the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or is it only Barnabas and I that have no right to refrain from working? Whoever goes to war at his own expense, who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit, or who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk of the flock? Do I say these things as a mere man? Or does not the law say the same thing also? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Is it oxen that God is concerned about? Or does he say it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he who plows should plow in hope, and he who threshes in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we have sown spiritual things for you, is it a great thing if we reap your material things? Okay, so here's a simple law pulled from Deuteronomy chapter 25. Do not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. Now, what sort of application would you get from reading this law? You know, perhaps we should have done that. We should have just went directly to Deuteronomy chapter 25 and read that law and then asked the question, what does that mean to you? You know, think about that and tell me what you think. Without reading Paul's commentary first, right? But now we have the benefit of hindsight. You know, we saw the way Paul has analyzed this, and so we kind of cheated a little bit. We read from Paul's commentary first. But anyway, let's take this section apart here in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Point number one, Paul identifies this law as the law of Moses. So clearly he's upholding the law of Moses as an authority in this matter. Point number two, Paul is addressing a Gentile congregation. Now, why in the world would he use the law of Moses as an authority with members in Corinth? Unless the law of God, yes, even the law of Moses, is not void and is not done away. Point number three, Paul is addressing members from a metropolitan area of Greece. You know, Corinth was a bustling city, and likely there was a great portion of members of the congregation that had nothing to do with livestock. So what are you talking to me about oxen for when I don't even own cattle? You know, what does that have to do with anything? You know, how about you and me? You know, likely many of us here don't own cattle. You know, perhaps some of us do. But likely you don't use that cattle as beasts of burden the way the law is describing here, right? You know, the ox is not treading out the grain for you. So clearly this law has no application for us in modern times, right? No, that's wrong. And we clearly saw why, because Paul states that the law is not even about cattle. Is it oxen that God is concerned about? Or does he say it for our sakes? So the law, in its strictest application, shows that we should allow our workers, yes, even our animals, to partake in and enjoy in a measure of the benefits of the labor. That's the law. And Paul could see that this attitude of kindness, this attitude of grace, demonstrated an aspect of God's mind that applied to all those who labor. And the overriding principle is this: a worker is worthy of his wages. A worker is entitled to share in the bounty of the work that's being done. Do you see what I mean, how we can see an aspect of the mind of God through meditating on this simple law? You know, we meditate on the law and we get an aspect of God's mind, a very glimpse into God's very nature and his very character. You know, God's a good God. You know, he's a nice God. That's kind of nice to know that we have a nice God to worship, right? The gods of the surrounding pagan nations are nasty and brutish gods, you know, that drank the blood of the children. But this God cares even about the welfare of the animals that are dedicated to service. And those who have committed themselves completely to the service of the ministry in God's church are worthy to receive wages. They're entitled to eat and have their wife and family eat. You know, Paul tells the members of Corinth that this is so, and he uses a law straight from the law of Moses as an authority. He applies that authority to a Gentile congregation. It might not even have had anything to do with cattle of any kind. You know, I think it's safe to say that the law is not done away in that case, right? The law of muzzling the ox while it treads out the grain, it's not done away. Now, again, how many of you would have come away from reading Deuteronomy 25 and concluded that this law is proof that a full-time minister should be provided for? You know, perhaps if your meditations were deep enough, you would have come to the same conclusion as Paul did. I don't know if I would have come to that conclusion. It's hard to know because, again, we have the benefit of hindsight. You know, we know the conclusion that Paul came to. And it makes sense. You know, it's logical. It's hard to refute. You know, I can imagine that there were some there in Corinth that said, "Now, wait a minute, Paul, you know, you're using this as an authority so that you can be provided for, but the law is talking about animals. You know, it's not even talking about people." Well, Paul's conclusion, is it really animals that God cares about, or is it people? If God has that much compassion on the animal, how much more on the people? You know, how can you argue with something like that? It's a brilliant discernment of the law based first on reading and knowing the law. You got to do that first. You have to read and know the law and then think about it deeply and try to understand God's mind in giving the law. And then Paul takes it to the next level by telling the Corinthians that they need to be doers of God's law. Now, how can you and I be doers of this law? How can we go home today and apply this law in our lives? Well, we do what we've probably been doing all along. Don't we? You know, we set aside 10% of our daily wages as belonging to God. We send it into the church administration. We tithe, you know. And under the current method of administration, that is how our full-time ministry is supported. You know, that is a magnification of the law that is found in Deuteronomy chapter 25. You know, besides other passages that support directly the notion that God's people do pay tithes, well, this passage tells us that we have a responsibility as God's people to see that those who are dedicated full-time in God's service receive compensation. And just as an FYI here, I think most of you know that I am not a paid employee of the church, you know, so this isn't me waving the flag for my paycheck, you know. I'm a lay member just like you all, so I don't have a stake in all that. Okay, so we have the pattern down, right? Jesus Christ teaches us how to look to the spiritual intent of the law. The Apostle Paul gave us a very insightful example of how he used the law. So let's look at some laws here then and see if we can think about it a little bit. Take it home with you. You know, meditate on it. Ponder it. See what it means. And see what God might be trying to get across with these particular laws. And so let's turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 22. We're going to hit a couple of laws here in Deuteronomy 22 that I find interesting, and I hope you will as well. But the first one is found in verse 9. Deuteronomy 22 and verse 9. We're going to look at this law, and then we'll see a similar statement made by the Apostle Paul and how he applied it to Christian living. So let's notice Deuteronomy 22 and verses 9 through 11. "You shall not sow your vineyard with different kinds of seeds, lest the yield of the seed which you have sown and the fruit of your vineyard is be defiled. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You shall not wear a garment of different sorts, such as wool and linen mixed together." Now, this is interesting. We have three laws here that seem to be somewhat unrelated to each other. You know, and perhaps if you were reading this through the law, you know, you might conclude that this is just a random listing of laws. You know, perhaps they don't need to be related to one another. It's just God says, don't do this, don't do that. They don't necessarily need to be directly related. But then we find a similar passage in the book of Leviticus. And let's turn over there. Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 19. Here in Leviticus 19, we're going to find that these same three laws are grouped together again. Let's notice that. Leviticus 19 and verse 19. You shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your livestock breed with another kind. You shall not sow your field with mixed seed, nor shall a garment of mixed linen and wool come upon you. Now, there are some minor variations here. You know, Deuteronomy tells us not to yoke different kinds of animals together, and Leviticus tells us not to crossbreed. So, but nevertheless, we have here what seems to be three unrelated laws that are linked together: the law of mixing livestock, the law of mixing seed, and the law of mixing fabrics. Now, I'd be fascinated to know some of the of your theories, you know, what you have, if you have spent any time meditating on these laws, you know, come and share them with me sometime. What is the issue with the mixing of fabric, for example? I've read several commentaries on this as I was doing the research. You know, some of them are perhaps a little more elaborate than others. You know, I'll try to be kind and just say that they're elaborate. From what I've seen, though, most if not all the commentaries I've read made clear that the prohibition was of mixing wool and linen specifically. It's not saying that all fabric must be of one material alone, you know, especially in regard to man-made fabrics such as nylon or polyester. You know, I don't even know what those fabrics are. You know, Mr. Hooser said he didn't know what crocheting is, means. I don't really know that either. But I don't know what this is. I have no idea. You know, what is nylon? What is polyester? I have no idea what that's made from. But the prohibition here specifically states not to mix wool and linen. And you know what? Before I studied into this, I didn't even know what linen was. You know, I know what wool is. You know, wool comes from sheep. You know, so the fibers that come off of the sheep's wool. Linen is a plant-based fiber that is made from flax. See, I didn't know that before. Now, is that the issue? That we shouldn't mix animal fibers and plant fibers? I don't know, possibly. Some of the commentaries state that the mixing of animal fibers and plant fibers together messes up the electrical field that our body puts off. You know, so, you know, like I said, some of these ideas are a little more elaborate than others. Could be true, you know. Others claim that, there is the idea that maybe the garment is cheapened somehow by mixing the flax in with the wool, and maybe you come up with an inferior garment. That could be very possible because you're talking about frauding, you know, especially if you're producing garments for sale to other people, you're talking about fraud, you know, giving someone an inferior garment. Now, others claim it was specifically tied to pagan religion of some element. Of what they did. You know, I'm more inclined to believe that because many of these laws that we might otherwise be scratching our heads about are in direct response to some twisted and bizarre thing that the pagan nations were doing around them while they were worshiping their gods. You know, boiling a young goat in its mother's milk, for example. Why would God need a law like that? I mean, that's sick and twisted. It's bizarre. Well, that's because that's what some of the neighboring pagan nations around them were doing. They would boil a young animal in its mother's milk, and I don't even want to get into that. That's just messed up. Either way, we have a law here that says do not mix wool and linen. Then we have a law that says don't sow mixed seed in the field. Again, I'm not certain what the prohibition there was. I don't think it takes much imagination to come up with some ideas. God created different kinds of grains, and each one of them are perfect in their original creation. I think that's safe to assume that. Why would we presume to think that we can improve on what God made? And yet, something is going on in our food supply today. A large segment of our population is allergic to food. You know, how can this be? You know, some have concluded that all grain is inherently bad. You know, you have the paleo diet, you have the keto diet, and they all seem to think that grain is evil. I do a lot of reading on health and fitness forums, you know, and I see this idea being put forth all the time. The current fad is to call it clean eating. They actually use that term. I eat clean. It's like, oh, you eat clean. Well, the idea of this goes back to the time before the agrarian age, to what the hunter-gatherers were eating. You know, that's the paleo diet in a nutshell. We eat like the cavemen did, because modern agrarianism is where humanity went off the track with food. And that is essentially the harvesting of grains. Now, first of all, I find that notion to be absurd. You know, there is no way that God designed and built ancient Israel, the very fabric of their society, around the grain harvest. They were an agrarian society, and much of the God's holy days and, you know, the seasons were built around the harvesting of grain. There is no way that God would do that if grain was evil. However, what if we messed up the grain? What if the grains that we're eating are genetically polluted over generations because we violated this law in Deuteronomy and in Leviticus? Again, the paleo people call their diet clean eating. And I used to chuckle over that because, you know, I've been clean eating for 30 years. You know, I came into God's church and I learned about the law of clean and unclean meats. You know, to me, that's clean eating. And that's probably what you probably think of too when you think of clean eating. Avoiding pork and shellfish and some of the other animals. But, you know, after I started to think about this, I began to meditate on these laws here in Deuteronomy and in Leviticus. I began to wonder if perhaps maybe the paleo people are onto something. If the grains we're eating are indeed ruined because of generations of mixed seeds, then calling it unclean might not be too far off the mark. I don't know. All I know is that it's not normal for such a large portion of our society to be allergic to grain. Something ain't right. And I don't believe the fault lies in the barley or the wheat or the rye that God originally created and intended us to harvest and eat. Well, you tell me what your thoughts are on this sometime. It'll be good discussion for us to have. You know, God says don't sow the field with mixed seeds. Now, what does that mean? Meditate on it. Think about it. And get back to me on that. Tell me what you think. Now we have the mixing of cattle. Deuteronomy says you should not plow with an ox and a donkey together. Leviticus says don't breed the two the animals together. You know, so it's pointless for me to speculate on the why here, since I'm not really a scientist in that sense. You know, other than to use the same argument that I did with the seed. You know, God created different kinds of things, and he created them perfect. So why would we need to presume that we can improve on what God made? So what's the common denominator here? Again, these are otherwise unrelated laws, right? Fabrics, seeds, livestock. And yet they're grouped together in two locations, in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy. Well, the common denominator is that some things don't mix. That's it. It's the mixing that's the issue, isn't it? And when we see that Israel was entering a land surrounded by the pagan nations that were around them, well, again, I'm inclined to believe that the real issue is with their interactions with their neighbors more than anything else. You know, maybe some of those other theories are true, the multiple theories there, electrical fields and all that stuff. But I know by reading the scriptures that God thought it very important that Israel do not mix with the pagan nations that were surrounding them. Israel was to be set apart as a holy people and were not to mix with those surrounding nations. And we have certain laws here where Israel was commanded not to mix certain things, otherwise they'll be defiled. But why are we even talking about this? You know, most of us here are not farmers, and if we were, we don't generally use animals in this fashion anymore. You know, we don't make our own fabrics out of the things that we produce on the farm. We have machinery that does our plowing. You know, although I grew up in Pennsylvania, you know, I've driven through Amish country a time or two, and I've seen men out in the fields pulling their plowshares with animals. You know, I've actually seen that. And so it's not unheard of today. But nevertheless, I think it's safe to say that this law is abolished, right? Well, okay, not abolished. You know, we've already seen that word doesn't work with regards to the law. Let's just say it's not applicable. It doesn't really apply to us. Let's turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. Let's see if the Apostle Paul would agree with that conclusion. Again, speaking to the Gentile congregation, speaking to city folks who aren't necessarily involved in agriculture as a primary occupation. Let's see how Paul skirts very close to the law regarding hooking an ox and a donkey together to perform work. You know, he doesn't quote the law verbatim, But the language here is strikingly close to and obvious that it seems that Paul has a certain law in mind. And tell me if you agree. So let's notice 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness? And what accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. You see, Paul could look at a law like this, the yoking of the different kinds of animals together. He could look at that law, he could meditate on it, he could ponder it, think about it, what does it mean? Why shouldn't we yoke two different kinds of animals together? And then he would clearly see that they simply don't mix properly. One animal might work differently from the other. You know, it would be a disaster to watch two different kinds of animals working together to perform the same goal, getting to that end of the row at the same time. Again, Paul said earlier, is it really oxen and donkeys that God cares about? Or is it people? Those who have been called by God in this age are on a different path than those who are following the ways of this world. You know, it's not a matter of being elite or exclusive, as we're often blamed when we want to set ourselves apart. You know, the law doesn't say that the ox is better than the donkey or vice versa. We're simply on a different path. You know, those people out in the world are going to get their time. You know, the time may be now. That's the world tomorrow, but not the world tomorrow, the Beyond Today program says that. The time is now. So the time might be now for them, or the time might be later in the second resurrection or whenever. They're on two different paths. Different animals that are not working together to effectively accomplish the same goals. They simply don't mix. And so over the years, one example that illustrates this principle perhaps better than any other is that of marriage. You know, what better illustration of yoking two people together to work their whole lives to the same end? You know, to seek first the kingdom of God and to raise godly children who will be taught God's commandments from their youth. And so the ministry has encouraged our young people to be careful who they seek out in marriage. Yes, you can fall in love with a person that is not in the church. Yes, there are good people whom God has not yet called that would make perfectly good and suitable husbands and wives. But our young people really need to think about this. Really think this through. Do you really want a situation where you're teaching your children about God's holy days, but then your spouse is teaching them to observe a whole different set of religious customs? You know, you're talking about the Feast of Tabernacles while your spouse is putting up Halloween decorations, followed by Christmas decorations. You're wanting to teach your children that your religion is based on 100% truth. But your spouse, they want to tell them about Santa Claus. You're probably wondering by now, Lynn, you know, we're 2 days away from Christmas. Aren't you going to talk about Christmas? Well, that's my statement on Christmas. Some things don't mix, right? The truth of God does not mix with pagan customs, period. That's my Christmas message. You know, my wife, that's how my wife Casey grew up. You can ask her about it sometime. You know, Casey's dad was a church member, but her mother was not. Now, it wasn't the end of the world for her. You know, she grew up in a loving environment. You know, both her parents loved her. She loved them back. But she'll be the first to tell you that there were conflicts now and again. Casey's mother was always supportive of the Feast of Tabernacles. You know, I can remember she used to enjoy going to the various locations as much as we all did. She'd hang out at the condo in the morning while Casey and her dad and her brother went off to services. And she enjoyed that too. She enjoyed her alone time at the condo. She had her coffee. She had her novel. She loved to be left alone to read novels. But, and you can understand this, she wasn't interested in spending the whole day there. You know, no one wants to do that when you're on vacation. You know, she was ready for the family to come back after services and so they could do things as a family. And that's understandable. I can totally understand why she would feel that way. The only issue is that immediately after services, Casey's dad was herding her and her brother out the door. You know, we got to hurry up and get back to mom. So right after the closing prayer, they were more or less out the door. Whatever else was going on as a church, well, they weren't really a part of that. Now, again, you ask Casey, and she'll probably tell you that her feast memories are great. You know, wonderful times. I spent a feast or two with her family. Great time. But I think she'll also tell you that there were pulls in two different directions. You know, an ox and a donkey not exactly pulling on the yoke in the same way. You know, it's not just marriage that this law applies to. Really, any human interaction we could see where this would apply. So, you know, I'm not just picking on our young people or people that are about to, you know, enter into that stage of their life. I own my own business. Now, would I want to enter into a partnership with somebody not in the church? Well, I suppose I could. Maybe all will be fine. Or maybe not. Maybe come feast time when I'm gone for 2 weeks, my unbelieving partner isn't going to be too happy about having to shut down for that long. Maybe my unbelieving partner is going to get slightly bitter about me walking off the job 30 minutes before sundown on a Friday. I've had to do that before. You know, I could see sundown was going to be in about 30 minutes, and I had clearly more than 30 minutes of work. And I had to go to the customer and say, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to see you on Monday. I've had customers that weren't very happy with me over that, but, you know, it's my business, so get over it, right? So, I didn't actually say that. I was very apologetic, but again, you know, my business, and that's how I'm going to operate things. But maybe my unbelieving partner might not think the same way. Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. That's a blunt statement right out of the scriptures. How do you think this law applies to your life? Well, take it home. Think about it. Meditate on it. Be a doer of the law. At the very least, go home this weekend and remember that God's ways do not mix with pagan symbols and their religion. You know, I know some of those ways seem harmless. I know some of those ways are very attractive. But they don't mix. Okay, so we've got the pattern down, right? You know, Jesus Christ taught us how to seek the spiritual intent of the law. The Apostle Paul demonstrates how even some of the most obsolete sounding laws have spiritual applications for us if we just attempt to discern the meaning. We have the psalmist that tells us that he meditates on God's laws all throughout the day. He thinks about them deeply. So how can you and I become better doers of God's laws? Well, as James told us, you know, we treat the Word of God like a mirror that we're able to look into and observe. We observe our own lives and our own actions in comparison to what the law says. And then we adjust ourselves accordingly. Just like we would adjust our hair with a comb when we're looking into the mirror. You know, we look into God's word, we pick a law, we delve into it, we get the spiritual intent, we apply it in our life, and we go home and we be doers of God's laws. Let's do that. Let's go home and meditate on God's laws all throughout the day. And then be doers of that law.